something crossed my mind that I have to share with you. This is what happens when you grow old. Just strange things pop into your mind. But the nice thing is, once you reach a certain age and have a certain position, then people have to listen to you when things pop into your mind. So I'll share this with you. I had mentioned some days ago in our discussion that in one of her letters, Flannery O'Connor had said that one of the regrets in her life is that she didn't get to write a screenplay for W.C. Fields, the great comic actor who, in fact, died in the early 40s, and she would have loved to have written a screenplay for him. If you don't know the W.C. Fields films, I encourage you to rent those sometime. You can find them. The Bank Dick is magnificent. It's one of the funniest movies ever made. You Can't Cheat an Honest Man, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, My Little Chickadee. They're wonderful movies and very funny. But those screen comedians, W.C. Fields, Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, the Marx Brothers, had a kind of genius. I mean, I said at the beginning of our sessions that art balances between entertainment and instruction, and that somehow really good art has to do both. And obviously, the comedian tends toward entertainment. A really great comic writer or a comic performer gives us that kind of entertainment. Well, what occurred to me, and I don't think I've mentioned this, is that there was a connection between Groucho Marx, known to you as Rufus T. Firefly, and T.S. Eliot. In fact, there's a volume out called The Groucho Letters, and a whole section of that book is the correspondence between T.S. Eliot and Groucho Marx. Eliot was a great fan of the Marx Brothers. And for years, Eliot and Groucho corresponded. And you follow these letters, and they keep trying to arrange a meeting. They had never met. They knew each other through correspondence. And Groucho loved Eliot's poetry. I mean, it seems hard to believe, but it's absolutely true. And finally, they arranged that they were going to be in London at the same time, and they were going to have dinner. And so Eliot and his wife invited Groucho and his wife to dinner. And fortunately, we have an account of it, because the next morning, Groucho wrote a letter to his brother Gummo giving an account of the meeting and said it was very nice and Mr. Eliot and his wife were very generous and it was a very good dinner, but he was a little disappointed in the talk after the dinner because Groucho had all these questions that he wanted to ask about the wasteland and the hollow men, and Eliot just wanted to talk about duck soup and animal crackers. And, you know, Groucho didn't want to talk about those old movies, they were boring, and Eliot didn't want to talk about his old poetry. So what you had, it was a case of two fans meeting. Eliot loving the movies, Groucho loving the poetry. But it's a surprising connection. Speaking of connections, let me begin by trying to make a little connection here between the two stories. They're very different in nature. Good Country People, I think, is one of the funniest things ever written. I find it uproariously funny. Everything That Rises Must Converge is not funny. There's some humor at the beginning, but as it goes on, it ceases to be funny. And in a way, it's one of the few things that O'Connor wrote that by the end we're not laughing. It's difficult to find humor in this story as it comes to an end. Nevertheless, I would say there's something in it. It grows out of a similar impulse. And that is a character type that shows up over and over again in O'Connor's stories. And it's a kind of character she could do particularly well. She must have understood it. There had to be some of this character in her. And it's something that she must have understood. And that character type is the young person, can be man or woman, who goes off to the university and gets a modern education and becomes filled with intellectual pride. That is a type. And then very often that young person ends up going home and living with mother. And mother is often depicted as old world, not too bright, either filled with sentimentality, as we saw with Mrs. Hopewell, or clinging to the past in some way, speaking in what I call fluent cliche, not terribly intellectual, and the clash is there. Now this had to be something that O'Connor knew from her own experience. She went off to college, she went to the University of Iowa, got a master's degree, she was highly acclaimed, her stories were doing very well, and then because of her illness, she had to return to Milledgeville, Georgia, and spend her time living on the farm with her mother, who was not an intellectual, who was very much a farm woman, and there had to be tensions. And those tensions, I think, get expressed artistically in many of these stories. In Everything That Rises Must Converge, we have that type. His name is Julian. And we know that Julian has been off to school in a number of different ways. He possesses that intellectual pride. He has a very distinctive, I'll just use that word for now, very distinctive view of his own mother, and there are real tensions between mother and son that define the story. Now, the story is curious in a couple of ways. I was just telling a few people that I often will begin a semester teaching literature with this story. It's my favorite way to begin a literature class. And it's particularly useful when I'm teaching the plebes, that is the freshmen. I will start their course with this story. Because the story is one big trap that it's easy to walk into. And the trap has to do with the fact that it is set up in such a way, it is written in such a way, and it deals with such sensitive subject matter that the students assume they know what they're supposed to think. And I can count on the fact that when I walk into class and start this story, and I always start by asking questions about the story, 99% of them are going to misread the story completely. First of all, they're not going to understand what the principal theme is. My first question to them is, what's the principal theme of this story? And they look at the title, they've given it a kind of hasty, quick read, and they give the standard response they're supposed to give, being good Americans who have been trained in the modern educational system, and they say, this is a story about race relations in the South. And it's set particularly at a time when the buses were first integrated. And what the story shows us is the terrible, prevalent racism that's in the South and how difficult it is to dislodge that prejudice. Next question then is, who's the hero of the story? Julian. Julian's the hero because he's gone off to school, he's been educated, he's learned to overcome his prejudices, and he's there trying to teach his mother, but his mother is Old South. She can't learn this lesson. There's the awful incident that takes place after they get off the bus. It's a very sad story, but what can you do? The old woman just couldn't learn. And O'Connor sets that up as a trap. And the minute my students say that, I can point my finger at them and say, intellectual pride. And they don't know what that means. So then I can go through and start explaining it to them, because as we take the story apart, it's not the story. They have read a different story. They have read a different story. They have not read the story that O'Connor put on the pages. What they have done is jumped to a whole set of assumptions that they've been given because they live in a world and they have been schooled not to think. They've been schooled to give automatic responses, just simply automatic responses, which is what creates the problem in the story. Now, let me show how give you a sense of how she sets this up in order to deliberately trick us. There is, if you will, in the story, the principal trick of the hats. We can call it a hat trick here, okay? So that what O'Connor is seemingly trying to make us think is that what she is talking about is this older woman who is filled with pride, and she's filled with pride in her own family, and she's filled with pride in her son, but she's basically racist. I'm using the modern terminology. She's basically a racist. And she buys this gaudy-looking hat, okay? A purple velvet flap came down on one side of it and stood up on the other. The rest of it was green and looked like a cushion with the stuffing out. I mean, it's got to be just this grotesquery, right? And then she goes and gets on the bus, and on the bus she sees a black woman who's riding the bus for the first time, who's wearing the same hat, and we get identification. The two women are the same. And the black woman has risen up. She's got the right to ride the bus. She has the right to go out and buy the hat. And we get a mirror image of the two women looking at each other. We get the convergence point. We get, if you will, matter and antimatter, and there's an explosion. And the explosion comes because the old white woman is racist. She was raised in that racist South with racist attitudes. And she still has a racist mindset. And the explosion comes and she gets punished for it. That's what the story seems to be, and the hat tricks us. The hat tricks us. The fact of the matter is we're talking about different kinds of convergences. We're talking about something that's very, very different. And curiously, you'll notice, in spite of the title, we have a family here that is descending. We have a family that was once quite wealthy and had a very nice plantation. That was in the Old South. We lost the house. The house is gone. That vision, and the mother, Julian's mother, clings to that because it was beautiful and ordered, and it was a way of life that possessed gentility, okay? And perhaps a degree of condescension, but for her it was a world that worked. If you think back to what I was saying yesterday in terms of Melville and part of what he was presenting, this is a world, the world in this little story is one where home is gone. We've lost home. And where they're living now is in a neighborhood that is not particularly pleasant, okay? The sky was a dying violet, and the houses stood out darkly against it. Bulbous, liver-colored monstrosity of a uniform ugliness, though no two were alike. The houses in this neighborhood are sort of like the hats. Ugly, bulbous, unpleasant. But no two are alike. There may be similarities. There may be things drawn together, but we don't have uniformity by any means. And all the way through, each house had a narrow collar of dirt around it in which sat usually a grubby child. By the end of the story, once we've made our journey, and this whole story is a little journey. It may look like a bus ride, but we're beginning somewhere, we're ending somewhere, and we're journeying along the way. O'Connor knows what she's doing. It may look like a bus ride. It's more than a bus ride. We've got a journey from point A to point B. We have a journey where we leave the pathetic little home we've got now, and we end up in the dark on an unknown street, surrounded by, remember, those tall, dark apartment houses. And they're like in a canyon, and they're little spots of light. But Julian goes running into the darkness trying to get help for his mother, and there's nobody there. There's nobody there. And obviously there may be hundreds of people living in these apartment houses, but they're empty. There's nobody there. There's nobody to help. The plantation is long gone, and it was filled with people. We meet some of them. We went to the house that was isolated and only had Julian and his mother, but it was home. We leave home and we get on this bus that's filled with strangers and a little bit of connection, and then suddenly we're off the bus and we're in this dark world with a tiny little street light where there are hundreds of people supposedly living, but there's no help. That's the journey, and it's a journey downward, and it's a journey into darkness, and this is a frightening story. Home's gone. It's lost. Now, one reason that I think to a degree we have to like the mother is she's trying to cling to the memory of something that was better than what is now. Yes, there may be a false gentility. Yes, that world may be gone, but at least as it's defined in the story, we understand why she clings to it, okay? We understand what it meant to her, what it represented for her. There's something else. She is desperately trying to give her son something, okay? I'll just read the, she says that he could not forgive her, that she had enjoyed the struggle and that she thought she had won. She has struggled for her son. She's done everything for her son. She's given everything of herself to her son. Please notice what we get in the story. This woman does keep giving. What she meant when she said she had won was that she had brought him up successfully and had sent him to college and that he had turned out so well. Good looking, her teeth had gone unfilled so that his could be straightened. Intelligent, he realized he was too intelligent to be a success. And with a future ahead of him. There was, of course, no future ahead of him. Now we've got this gap between what she thinks and what he knows. Fact of the woman, the woman has sacrificed everything. Here's a tragedy. O'Connor's onto it. We have all these generations of parents who sacrificed and sacrificed so they could send their children to college where the children would learn to hate their parents. I mean, it's simply unbelievable. And then these children filled with intellectual pride come home and treat their parents miserably. Julian treats his mother miserably. He's just awful to her. And we get it all the way through. I'm not going through all the references. The story's just loaded with it. He resents the fact he has to live with her. He resents who she is, where she comes from, and what the few little desperate things she clings to so there can be any kind of meaning in her life at all. He resents that he has to go out of his way a little bit to assist her. It's clear, the woman's teeth are rotting so that he could have his fixed. She's got high blood pressure and he is resentful that he has to get on the bus one night a week and ride with her to the Y because she's frightened. And he resents her for it. It's just, oh. Okay? And that resentment is everywhere. And he treats her miserably. I'm not going to look through the scenes. I find them almost too painful to look at. The way he's treating her all the way through the story is simply horrible. Now, he excuses his lousy treatment of his mother. He's come up with the excuses in his own mind. He is entitled to treat his mother miserably because she is uneducated and a racist. Okay? She doesn't know anything. She is a racist. She is uncultured. And he says, true culture is in the mind. The mind, he said and tapped his head. The mind. And he may be a typewriter salesman living in this awful little house with his own mother, but he has culture because he has it in his mind and he learned it at school. And for him, culture is being kind to the Negro race. That's culture. And that proves he's got it. And she doesn't, and therefore he has a right to look down on her. But she counters and says, it's in the heart, she said, and in how you do things. And how you do things is because of who you are. Okay? She holds to that old vision of gentility. She keeps saying, you've got to know who you are. Now, it's clear she doesn't really know who she is, but she has a better sense of self, I would claim, than Julian. How do we know that? Because he claims, I have culture, I have the mind, I am educated, and yet curiously. Let's face it. And this is the first twist in the story. Julian is in many ways worse than his mother. If there are tiny ways in which, as he says, she condescends to the blacks, he is 100 times worse. And we get the descriptions of when he would get on a bus, he would always try to find a black person to sit next to expiate his mother's sins against the black people, he says, okay? Of course, what he's doing is he is simply trying to follow a set of trendy ideas he has been taught, and he does not view them as human in any way. They're a symbol for him. A symbol of what? His own liberality of mind. We get one little scene acted out. This is just, well, there are a couple of them that are very good. He tells one time when he sat down on the bus, he always tries to sit next to someone who is intelligent, okay, who would look as if had a good education. And the one time he sits down thinking he found a doctor or a professor or a preacher, and it turns out it was an undertaker, okay. It's a wonderful little joke. And the next time he sits down to a man who looks very wealthy, he's wearing diamond rings, okay, and then the black man leaves him a couple of lottery tickets as he goes. I mean, it's just, okay. This is O'Connor, by the way, at her best. The little joke about the undertaker is very funny, but in context, she's already pointing to the end of the story. We're going to have a death at the end of the story, and there's not even going to be an undertaker there to take care of the body. That's how empty and dead this world she's presenting has become. And Julian's a big part of it. In any case, he finally sits down, the black man gets on the bus, and he deliberately, of course, then goes and sits next to this man. And he felt his tension suddenly lift as if he had openly declared war on her. He's going to fight his mother by getting her upset, by proving how open-minded and liberal he is. And he goes and sits next to this man. He would have liked to get in conversation with the Negro and to talk with him about art or politics or any subject that would be above the comprehension of those around them. But the man remained entrenched behind his paper. What have we got? We have another man. He's just a guy. He's reading the paper on the bus. What Julian is doing, of course, is elevating on the basis of race. He's black, therefore he must be intelligent. He must know art. He must know politics. And not seeing an inability to see an individual. He was either ignoring the change of seating or never noticed it. There was no way for Julian to convey his sympathy. It was just said earlier he has no sympathy with his mother, and he hisses at her, he growls at her. It's his mother. But he will show sympathy to this man simply because, what? The man has black skin. Doesn't know him, knows nothing about him. The man isn't particularly interested, but he is trying to convey sympathy for a race. Get real. This is nonsense. This is utter nonsense. I'm going to make the case it's worse than what his mother is doing. I'll try to show that in just a moment. His mother kept her eyes fixed reproachfully on his face. The woman with the protruding teeth was looking at him avidly as if he were a type of monster new to her. We got complex interactions going on here, nobody seeing clearly. The one thing we don't have operating here is any kind of functioning human society. We got types looking at types, judging by type. "Do you have a light?" he asked the Negro. Without looking away from his paper, the man reached in his pocket, handed him a packet of matches. "Thanks," Julian said. For a moment he held the matches foolishly, and no smoking sign looked down upon him from over the door. This alone would not have deterred him. He had no cigarettes. He had quit smoking some months before because he could not afford it. "Sorry," he muttered, and handed back the matches. The Negro lowered the paper and gave him an annoyed look. He took the matches and raised the paper again. The paper's a barrier. The paper's a wall. He doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to be condescended to by white liberals. He's sick of that as well. Okay? And what we've got, we're on the bus, we're moving forward, but the tensions are increasing all the time. Now, the black woman with the child gets on, and now we have the real convergence, and it's not through the hats. It's from the beginning of the story, when Julian, in speaking of his mother, whom he loathes, he can't stand this woman, and he shows it in his treatment of her, looks into her eyes early on, and her eyes were as innocent and untouched by experience as they must have been when she was 10. She's learned nothing from experience, but she remains innocent. She's an old woman, but there's innocence in her. Okay? She might have been a little girl that he had to take to town. In fact, she is a little girl. There's still something of the child about her. "I remember going to Grandpa's," she says, "when I was a little girl." Her memories are all about the time when she was a little girl, when she went to Grandpa's house, how she loved the house, and we learn as well, okay, that she got along very well, particularly, she says, "I remember the old darky who was my nurse, Caroline. There was no better person in the world. I've always had a great respect for my colored friends. I do anything in the world for them," and they, and he can't listen to it. Okay? Yes, she's being condescending, but what we have there that we don't get anywhere else in the story is a link between one real person, a little girl, and one real person, a nursemaid named Caroline, and color didn't matter. For one instant in one relationship, we have love going back and forth. We can call it real Christian charity. A little girl who loved her nursemaid. A nursemaid who loved a little girl. That's all we're going to see in this story except for one other little moment, and it comes on the bus when there's a convergence, and it's an older woman who loves a little boy, and a little boy who loves being with an older woman. And now the races are reversed. It's an older white woman who plays peekaboo games with a little boy, and the little black boy who loves sitting next to her and cuddling up to her and playing peekaboo with her. And we have another moment of an actual connection in which race doesn't matter. Except to Julian and the black mother, who are both filled with pride and can only see race. And Julian can only see his mother condescending, and the black woman can only see the whole white race condescending to her little boy. And we've got, as we're going to have it described, the machine, we've got the pressure building. Blood pressure in the old white woman, a different kind of pressure in the black woman, and we're going to get a convergence. Things are rising. Blood pressure is rising. Hatred is rising. In a world devoid of charity. In a world devoid of charity, okay? O'Connor keeps emphasizing the childlike nature of the mother. Just one other example. Julian looks across the bus, and there's his mother sitting on the seat. She must be a short woman. Her feet in little pumps dangled like a child's and did not quite reach the floor. Okay? Over and over again. This older woman is described as a child. For a moment, he had an uncomfortable sense of her innocence, but it lasted only a second before principle rescued him. What he's calling his principle is a refusal to see his mother as an actual woman, okay? And we get the black mother filled with hatred for the other child here, the little black child, playing peekaboo with the white woman, and the black mother gets furious. The woman slapped his hand down. "Quit your foolishness," she said, "before I knock the living Jesus out of you." What is she going to knock out of him? She's going to knock the living Jesus out of him. She wants to raise him so he will have no love for those outside himself who are white. There will be no Christian charity in him. She's going to teach him to hate. I mean, it's one of those brilliant moments in O'Connor. She doesn't use a line like that without knowing what she means. And it is indeed that love that does not see difference. It is that love that goes out to all one by one, which is the only way charity can work. And of course, what's happened in this story, the lie in this story is that it's possible to love all of a race or all of mankind without loving individuals. And in fact, what you find is, and it's simply a fact in the world, that those who spend all their time talking about love of large groups are some of the meanest people you ever want to meet. And there's no dealing with them one-on-one. And they don't have to deal with you one-on-one because they've already got their credentials that they spend all their time spouting these ideas about loving large groups or loving all of mankind. If you ever encounter anybody who starts talking to you about the brotherhood of man, turn and run the other direction. Because as O'Connor knows, at that moment you're confronting something that is demonic. Because that's not how we, as flawed human beings, can love. It's quite enough for us to love one-on-one. I don't have the capacity. I don't have the heart. It's unlikely I'm going to love the whole human race. That is a godlike attribute. But even God loves one at a time. One at a time. Okay? Now, made the point, we get this connection. We get the convergence. We get the older little girl who's a mother. We get the little black boy who's a child. They come together. And this is where I can get the students finally, okay? I say to them quite simply, let's imagine you're a little boy on the bus. Let's imagine you're a child. And let's imagine you get off that bus and suddenly a stranger comes up to you and gives you a coin, hands you a penny. Tell me as a child, from the child's point of view, what your response is going to be. And unanimously they have to say, "Wow, money. Somebody gave me money. This is great." The action to the child is a wonderful thing. Is a wonderful thing. Then the second question. Tell me the motive of this old woman opening up her purse, hoping to find a nickel, just finding a penny, but saying, "Well, at least it's a shiny penny. It's a shiny new penny." What does that matter? Why does she care? She cares because what does she want to give to this little boy? something special, something unique, something that matters. What that shiny penny represents is a tiny moment of love that passed between them while they were on the bus. That's what she's handing. And she wishes it could be more, but the fact of the matter, and O'Connor knows it, she's limited. This old woman is limited. She wishes to give a nickel, she can only give a penny. She is narrow. She is a product of where she grew up. She is old in many ways, in old ways she is narrow, but the penny is still shining, and it's worth something. And the transaction is completed. Oh, little boy, Julian's mother called and took a few quick steps and caught up with them just beyond the lamppost. The action is going to take place in that edge between light and dark, which is where everything is going to happen here at the end of the story, although then we're going to move into the darkness. Here's a bright new penny for you, and she held out the coin, which shone bronze in the dim light. The light may be dim, but what is that coin doing? It's shining. The huge woman turned and for a moment stood, her shoulders lifted and her face frozen with frustrated rage, and stared at Julian's mother. Then all at once she seemed to explode like a piece of machinery that had been given 1 ounce of pressure too much. Julian saw the black fist swing out with the red pocketbook. He shut his eyes and cringed as he heard the woman shout, "He don't take nobody's pennies." What she is saying is, he does not accept condescending love from white women. And we have a real convergence. This black woman hates Julian's mother just as much as Julian does. That's the convergence. The black woman has risen up socially, Julian has risen up intellectually, and what have they learned? To hate. And that hate gets turned into an action, and the purse swings, blam! And Julian's mother is punished for attempting to love a child. Because this new world has no room for that Christian charity. When he opened his eyes, the woman was disappearing down the street with the little boy staring wide-eyed over her shoulder. The little boy is learning a lesson here. We can guess what he's going to be like in 20 years. Julian's mother was sitting on the sidewalk. "I told you not to do that," Julian said angrily. "I told you not to do that." He stood over for a minute, grinning his teeth. His mother is on the sidewalk having been hit by a stranger, and what's he doing? Condemning her. "You got exactly what you deserved," he said. "Now get up." Note the treatment. He picked up her pocketbook and put what had fallen out back in it. He picked up the hat off her lap. The penny caught his eye on the sidewalk, and he picked that up and let it drop before her eyes into the purse. "You keep your love. Don't you dare go around handing out love like that. You keep that in your purse." The purse in the black woman having become what? The object of hate swung out. Love that is retained, love that does not go forward, love that is bottled up, turns into hate. Julian hates his mother. Then he stood up and leaned over and held his hands out to pull her up. She remained immobile. "Okay, come on, get up." And she can't respond. He sighed. Rising above them on either side were black apartment buildings. Notice, black. This hatred's all around. Marked with irregular rectangles of light. There's a little light, but where is it? It's irregular, just in places. And basically, there is darkness. And they are in the dark. At the end of the block, a man came out of a door and walked off in the opposite direction. Another stranger, we hear nothing more about him, but what? "I'm not getting involved, I'm out of here." "All right," he said, "suppose somebody happens by and wants to know why you're sitting on the sidewalk. Don't you embarrass me anymore tonight. What's his focus? Self, 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 as it's been through the whole story. She took the hand and, breathing hard, pulled heavily up on it and then stood for a moment, swaying slightly as if the spots of light in the darkness were circling around her. Wait a minute. The center of a circle of light spinning around her? We've had this before earlier in the week. Could Flannery O'Connor have been reading her Dante? Who's at the center of that light? A pilgrim. A pilgrim. Just as the poor mother has been a pilgrim on the bus, she's learned a hard lesson. But she's all that exists of any kind of decent charity in this dark world. Her eyes, shadowed and confused, finally settled on his face. He did not try to conceal his irritation. "I hope this teaches you a lesson," he said. She leaned forward and her eyes raked his face. She seemed trying to determine his identity. Then, as if she found nothing familiar about him, she started off with a headlong movement in the wrong direction. She looks at her own son and realizes, "I don't know you. You're not my son." And heads off in the wrong... I'll tell you, this is heartbreaking stuff. This is not O'Connor at her... This isn't comedy. This isn't comedy. "Aren't you going on to the why?" he asked. "Home," she muttered. "Well, are we walking?" I'm going to skip over some of this. He keeps lecturing her. She's breathing fast. It's clear she's had a stroke. The high blood pressure has caused her to have a stroke. "Let's wait on the bus," he said. "Home," she said thickly. Of course, home is gone. The son she'd hoped to raise is gone. "I hate to see you behave like this," he said, "just like a child," which is what she is. He uses it as an insult. "You're supposed to be mature. You're supposed to be a grown-up woman. You're supposed to have good liberal ideas. It's a shame you didn't go to a university. Then you wouldn't behave like this. I should be able to expect more of you." He decided to stop where he was and make her stop and wait for a bus. "I'm not going any farther," he said, stopping. "We're going on the bus." She continued to go on as if she had not heard him. She doesn't see him. She can't hear him. There's no connection. He took a few steps and caught her arm and stopped her. He looked into her face and caught his breath. He was looking into a face he had never seen before. Now, look, two things. One, it is a different face. It's contorted. She's had a stroke. He's not seen her near death before. But he's also seeing and hearing something he hasn't seen before. She has now become the little girl she was years ago. And now we know what she means when she's calling for going home. "Tell Grandpa to come get me," she said. In her last moment, she becomes that which she had dreamed for, hoped for, that which is best in her, really a little girl, wanting to go home, calling out for Grandpa. He stared, stricken. Uh-oh. He now realizes the fact. "Tell Caroline to come get me," she said. Those are her last words. Her last words call out for a black woman. Not something a racist would do. But it's beyond that. Her last words call out for the one person in her life that at the end of her life she knows loved her unconditionally. Unlike her son. And with her last breath she calls out for a black nursemaid. "Tell Caroline to come get me," she said. Stunned, he let her go, and she lurched forward again, walking as if one leg were shorter than the other. A tide of darkness seemed to be sweeping her from him. It's called death. "Mother," he cried, "darling, sweetheart, wait." Suddenly, he's speaking language he's never used before. It's excessive. "Darling, sweetheart." Crumpling, she fell to the pavement. He dashed forward and fell at her side, crying, "Mama, Mama," what's he just become? A little boy. Unless she become as a child again. He turned her over. Her face was fiercely distorted. One eye, large and staring, moved slightly to the left as if it had become unmoored. The other remained fixed on him, raked his face again, found nothing, and closed. Wait here," he cried, and jumped up and began to run for help toward a cluster of lights he saw in the distance ahead of him. "Help! Help!" he shouted, but his voice was thin, scarcely a thread of sound. The lights drifted farther away the faster he ran, and his feet moved numbly as if they carried him nowhere. There's no help in this world. There's nowhere to run to. He doesn't have a voice. There's nothing out there. The tide of darkness seemed to sweep him back to her, postponing from moment to moment his entry into the world of guilt and sorrow. He's better off at the end. He's learned something. What has been the price of his lesson? The death of his mother on a city street. And knowing that in her last moment, she did not even know who he was. There is that degree of hope there at the end of the story. As is often the case with O'Connor, the death of the mother in this awful way has been good for the son. There is now hope for him. But that hope has come through what? The suffering, pain, and death of another. Why was she condemned? Why did she have to die on the street? Because there was in her a little glimmering of love that still remained in this dark, dark world. Let me sum it up this way. Let me put it just very briefly. The problem with the modern world's phony vision of love, where we love all, is the fact that it creates in us a pride that makes us unable to love those immediately around us. Julian has, in a way, become more prejudiced than his mother ever was. That is, judging blacks by the color of their skin alone, with a phony love that had nothing to do with human contact with real human beings. And the price he paid was violating a commandment: honor thy mother and father. And he not only did not honor her, but there was not even any human connection there at all other than hatred. And quite simply, it's this. Everything that rises must converge, yes, with one human being loving another human being, and through that simple act of charity connecting in the only way that is possible, and that is a Christian caring for one's neighbor, or for one's friend, or for one's mother. And if you want to know how much charity there really is in that world out there, the next time you talk to one of these people, ask them about their parents and see how they respond. And the fact of the matter is, and O'Connor knows it, there will not be a healing between the races in this country until, on a more basic level, there can be love between parent and child once again. Tomorrow morning, a temple of the Holy Ghost.